Support for On Point and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Lift the burden of getting a home loan with Rocket Mortgage and get a secure, transparent home loan approval in minutes. Skip the bank, skip the waiting, and go completely online at quickenloans.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. The fourth industrial revolution is coming, we're told, and this time it's bringing robots. The technology is getting better and better. Robots are becoming part of the mainstream workforce, and not only in manufacturing, but in construction, the medical field, and beyond. Some say your next home might be built by robots. How will robots change the way the world works? This hour On Point, the robots just keep coming. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Do you work with a robot already? What can you see coming? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first today in the studio is Charlie Wood, reporter for the Christian Science Monitor. His recent headline caught our eye, "Will Your Next Home Be Built by Robots?" You can link to the piece at our website, onpointradio.org. Charlie Wood, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Happy to be here.
So, all right, all the guys with their tool belts out there and putting up the new house. Instead, if a robot's sitting there, can that happen? Can a robot sit there and build me a home?
It looks promising, at least in terms of the actual walls. I mean, a home is built of tons of stuff, roofs, windows, plumbing. And at the moment, we've seen a number of startups that have actually demonstrated that we can use 3D printing to create the walls of a house by laying down layer after layer of concrete that then quickly hardens, much in the same way that a tabletop 3D printer lays down layer after layer of plastic.
What does this look like? Is it a million little robots running around, spitting out, something? Or is it one great big one sitting in the middle with lots of arms? Or paint a picture for us.
So it's interesting you mentioned the many, lots of little robots, because there are many teams. For example, Harvard has their Termes robot, inspired by termites, that is looking at stacking up blocks. But that's more of like
inspired
a tabletop.
Inspired by termites, phrase I've never heard before, but good, okay.
But yeah, robots working together.
Okay.
And that's more of a tabletop demonstration at the moment.
Okay.
In terms of what's actually already out in the field being tested on the prototype level, we're seeing robotic arms that can have a print head on the end. And the arm has 360 degrees freedom of movement,
okay.
And this arm spins around and puts down layer after layer of concrete.
So it would build it kind of from the ground up.
Exactly.
And what comes up is essentially the frame of a home.
That's right. And then you could put into that frame whatever you wanted. So later on, you could have people come in and put in wiring. You could put in insulation. But yeah, at the moment, it's just the frame for the house.
And how does this work? I input the blueprints for the home, so or software, the instructions as to what I want built here?
Yeah, exactly. You put in the blueprints, and then the robotic arm knows where it is in space and then puts down these layers. And so when you print a page from your computer, for example, you know exactly how much ink it takes, how much paper it takes, and how long it's going to take. So it always finishes on time and on budget. And as you know, that's a huge problem for the construction industry. So
yes,
people are hoping to bring those gains to the industry.
What are the current, possibilities or limitations of this? Can I have a 2-room house? Can I have a 20-room house?
Right. So obviously you can only build as large as your arm is. Right?
Yeah,
so that's somewhat limiting. But there are plans to build one floor and then pick the arm up and put it on the next floor. So there's some thinking for how to expand. But at the moment, the prototypes that have been built are mostly one-person small housing. So for example, Apis Core is a startup in Russia.
Uh-huh.
They were able to build a 400-square-foot house in one day. And then MIT Media Lab has what they're calling a digital construction platform that prints form molding that you can then pour concrete into. And this thing also is about 50 feet wide by about 12 feet tall. So this is the scale we're talking about right now.
Okay, so it's something from a tiny house scale to something a bit bigger than that.
Right.
And as I listen here, this is not wood frame construction like most American homes. This is Cement or concrete, or you tell me.
Yeah, it's concrete. Right?
Okay.
Both of these two approaches, APUS Core uses concrete directly, and MIT's digital construction platform uses plastic and then pours concrete inside. And as you said, most houses in America have wooden frames. So actually, these companies are looking abroad first, for example, Russia and Asian markets where concrete is a more common construction material for residential housing.
Yeah, I've been in a lot of countries where you can see plenty of concrete houses, but here this relatively rare. Is that something that would appeal to an American market, a concrete house?
I don't know. We'll have to put it out there and find out. But that's certainly one of the obstacles, is who knows what the social implications and how easy people want to accept this kind of a house.
Is there a compromise here? If these are going to be cheaper and come in on time, if you're willing to live in a house of X material that has Y shape, I mean, are there limitations that consumers might be asked to accept? You want a cheaper robot-built house? Well, it's going to have to look like a shipping container. And here you go.
Well, it's interesting you bring up the idea of shape, because once you have a robot arm, I mean, this thing doesn't care if you're printing a box or a dome or a dodecahedron. You can make any shape that you want.
I'm sorry, what was the last?
A dodecahedron.
I've never stepped into one of those. What's that?
Well, not yet. It's, I think, 12-sided shape, a 12-sided figure.
Okay.
So you haven't yet, because we don't have the technology. Or maybe we do, but it would be quite expensive. You know, we're still building things the same way we were 50 years ago, stacking up rectangular objects on top of other rectangular objects, sometimes by crane, sometimes by hand. But some people want to change all that.
This would mean minimal waste, you're saying, because they'd calculate exactly what they need. When I think of the home construction industry, I think of dumpsters full of waste, of excess, you know, you name it, everything that doesn't quite get used, that gets cut off, that gets thrown out. You're talking about a different scenario here.
That's exactly right, Tom. Actually, in America, the number one producer of solid waste is the construction industry. And so if you could print this, you could get rid of all of that. So not only is this a benefit for consumers, but it's also a huge gain for the environment.
I've got a little sound here from, I don't know, this doesn't quite, this is an embellishment of what you're describing. This is a bricklaying robotic assistant called a SAM, a semi-automated mason. And Scott Peters here, Peters is the co-founder of the Construction Robotics, little business that created this. He says it's designed to increase productivity and reduce heavy lifting burdens on construction crews.
The mason still works alongside SAMs. They're still responsible for setting SAM up. They're still responsible for striking the joints and ensuring the best wall quality and using some of the knowledge and the skills that they have, but they don't have to have the physical demand on their body that they might previously.
All right, so there's a scenario in which even once you get a frame up, now you want to clad it in brick or whatever the case may be, and you've got a robot who's going to come in and help you just lay down brick after brick after brick. That sounds like a very robotic job as well.
Yeah, one can imagine you have a robot for bricklaying, the arm for printing the walls. You could have an arm for putting in wiring. I know that the MIT's digital construction platform, they call it a platform, right?
Okay.
And the lead author, Stephen Keating, he emphasized that it's not a 3D printer only. They can also cut with it. They can mold with it. You can finish with it. It's a robotic arm. And like any human arm, what the tool you put in it can expand its functionality.
So this is just one field, but home building is a big area of employment. What's being projected here?
Yeah, I mean, that's hard to say. I asked this question to all my sources, and they're reluctant to try to forecast the future. But they think that the consensus seems to be that this change is coming slower than we might expect. I mean, there are still many obstacles before we can see houses being built by machines here and there, especially the safety codes. We depend, our lives depend mm-hmm. on the buildings that surround us every hour of every day, and we have no tolerance for failure. So the industry is understandably very slow to innovate. And once you have safety codes that work, don't fix it. So if you're a construction company in Minnesota, and here APUS Core is offering you a newly developed quick drying cement technique, how do you know that that's going to last for 30, 50, 100 years mm-hmm. of Minnesota winters of freezing and thawing? So you have to, I mean, there are ways of testing this in the lab, but at the end of the day, you don't know 100% until it's out in the field.
But we do know that you've got people out there working on this very deliberately and very steadily. We've seen what happened with self-driving cars. Mm-hmm. It seems like 2 seconds ago, that was just a wild idea. And now here they come. Gordon in Davie, Florida. Thank you for calling, Gordon. You're on the air.
Yeah. Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking the call.
Yeah.
I've been around, lived out of the country most of my life, and worked in different theaters and cultures. My point of calling up is back in the 70s, I made an argument and brought in a point, wrote to some of the House of Representative people and this and that, and I said, why are we not taxing and creating contributions from companies that make wide use of robots? In other words, you're deleting human labor and expeditiously advancing the production profile. But in the meantime, things like IRS, Medicare, whatever we collect off the payroll is politely put away and forgotten. And had we adapted to that back in the 70s, you wouldn't be in these huge, crazy deficits that we are today.
Gordon, let me pick up just the nut of that, if I may, because our time is short before the break. But, I mean, payroll taxes on all those construction jobs do go into funding an awful lot of things for people. Can you picture a future? I don't know. Yeah, you, Charlie, 10, 15, 20, 30 years from now, when it's, you know, a new subdivision going up, robots come in instead of work crews.
Yeah, I absolutely can. And again, at the moment, we still need people to do the finishing and other stuff. But at least for the construction itself, it's certainly conceivable that we won't need people to do that anymore in the future. But at the same time, there's a silver lining here, right? Construction is one of the most dangerous jobs in America. According to OSHA, more than 20% of in the work fatalities happen on the construction site. So, and at the same time, construction of the future could be safer and also less physically demanding if we have robots out there on the front lines doing the heavy lifting, so to speak. So this is not an entire loss, in my opinion.
May permit all whole new forms of homes, much more elaborate ones you can just sort of punch in anything. On the other hand, it's been an awful lot of people employed for an awful long time. Yes, with those risks, but even so, it's going to take some rethinking of how the whole world, the economy, society fits together if robots are really making major interventions, even on home building.
Absolutely. And not just in construction, but we're seeing this in a ton of industries. And this is going to have to be a conversation we're going to have as a society, is how to employ people who are displaced by technology.
Charlie Wood with the Christian Science Monitor. His piece headlined, "Will Your Next Home Be Built by Robots?" Charlie, thank you so much for joining us today. Great to have you right here.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about robots and the jobs they are doing. Behind me right there, automatic rendering machine, robot laying cement on a wall at work. Easy Renda. It's from. But that's just one facet of where robots are working today and many more coming down the road. We're looking at the jobs that robots are doing now, the jobs that they'll do next, and how we will live with robot colleagues this hour. Some say it's going to be great, free up people to do other things. Here's Bill Gates, no less, Microsoft co-founder. This was a February interview with Quartz, saying, sure, robots will take over routine jobs, but that'll free up the people to do emotion-based work, teaching or elderly care or lots of things. Here's Gates.
If you can take the labor that used to do the thing automation replaces, and both financially and training-wise and fulfillment-wise, have that person go off and do these other things, you're net ahead.
You're net ahead. Here come the robots. You can join us this hour. What do you think? Could a robot do your job? And if you're thinking no, are you sure? And what do you see happening on this front already? What do you see coming? How deep will the robot presence in our workplaces be? And are you seeing it already? Let's bring in a couple of people who know a lot about what's going on with robots. Ken Goldberg joins us from Berkeley, California. He's a roboticist, professor of industrial engineering and operations research in robotics, automation, new media at the University of California, Berkeley. Ken, welcome back to On Point. Thanks very much for being here.
Oh, thank you, Tom.
And with us from Pittsburgh, Howie Chosett joins us, professor at Carnegie Mellon's Robotic Institute, expert designer of snake robots used in surgery. It's terrific to have you with us again, Howie, as well. Thanks so much for being here.
Yeah, thank you for having me, Tom.
Howie, we're hearing here about the potential for robots in building homes. I think people have a pretty clear image in mind of robots at this point in, let's say, auto factories. But can you give us a little sense of the horizon of applications here? Where are robots at work already, and where do you see them headed in the next iteration?
So robots are going to be participating in our lives in a variety of ways. We're seeing the self-driving cars as an example, medical robotics being able to deliver surgical-level care at a fraction of the cost and with the same efficacy to more people. We're going to see robots in agriculture, robots, of course, in search and rescue and supporting our defense. And we hear about robots in the factory already. We know robots, paint cars, weld cars. But we're going to see other uses of robots in automation as well. And I think what's exciting about this is we'll see the role of robots supporting small manufacturing organizations in addition to the large companies.
When you talk about medical robotics in surgery, what do you mean? Robots doing surgery? Like, hey, here I am. I'll lie down. Just go to town, robot?
No, no. A robot is a very complicated system. And what you have with medical robots is that the surgeon, or really the physician, is driving the mechanism to carry out a task, and at the same time, the task is providing the physician a better situational awareness that was otherwise lost when doing minimally invasive surgery. The big picture here is we want to have less pain for the patient, we want to drive costs down, and we want to be able to deliver medical care by more people and to more people. In other words, we want to democratize medical care.
So you're talking about robots working with human medical personnel in that scenario at this point?
That's correct. There's always this big question, what is a robot? So if you were to watch a surgeon using a medical robot to perform a diagnostic or a therapy, you might think, actually, the robot is more like a remote-controlled mechanism that the surgeon drives. But the truth is, there are algorithms, there is autonomy under the hood that allow the physician to express higher-level commands, make creative decisions, and then the computer and the robot deals with the low-level grungy stuff that can be cognitively burdensome on the physician, and yet just a distraction and doesn't add anything to his ability to perform the procedure.
Ken Goldberg in Berkeley, we're seeing all kinds of headlines lately about robots picking apples and robots, not immigrants, taking American jobs. I saw one headline here saying robots could take over 38% of U.S. jobs within about 15 years. That blows one's hair back. Maybe it's great, but we have to figure out what people do, if that's the case. As Howie describes what robots are doing and will do, it feels to a layman like me, there's two sides. There's the physical presence of the robot, but then AI, or artificial intelligence, seems to be awfully important here too. How much of what we call robotics will be a physical presence, and how much will be, I don't know, if someone takes my job? If a robot takes my job, it wouldn't have much physical presence, but if it could sort of, listen to questions and offer responses and ask more questions, it would just be AI at work. Is that a robot?
Well, Tom, listen, I'm going to have a different view on this, and I will tell you, your job is completely safe. Oh. We're nowhere near having robots be able to do things like journalism or almost all the things that are claimed, including driverless cars, I'm extremely skeptical about.
Really? But we see they're going down the roads all the time. I'm out in California. I see them.
No, there's a human in those cars watching things and checking out, making sure. Now, the idea of a robot, essentially a system that can assist a driver in the same way that Howie was just talking about for the surgeon, that I believe in very much. But a fully autonomous car where you'll be able to put your kids in the car and it will take them to soccer practice, we're not going to see that for at least 10 years. And I'm willing to take bets on it. It's just the problem is way too hard.
Okay.
And we are in a case of a huge mythology that we've actually seen before. In the 60s, in the 70s, in the 80s, there were similar predictions. And what's important to remember is that robotics is extremely difficult.
Yeah.
And so these jobs are not going to go away. I disagree with the idea that you will have construction workers replaced by robots. Try putting in plumbing or electrical wiring that with a robot. That is not going to happen.
Because it's just too subtle, you mean?
It's way too subtle. So we can stamp out bricks Absolutely. I don't doubt that. We already do that with machines. But the idea of being able to go in and actually wire up a house, do the all the nuances of the fine finishes and things like that, putting it, laying carpet, for example, or any kind of finishing, that's extremely difficult, very far beyond anything that robots can do now or even in the foreseeable future.
Okay, a couple thoughts there. One is, yes, I can see how hard that is given our current expectations of homes, but if they become more standardized, I don't know if there might not be a way. Maybe our homes won't look the way they look now. But also, the other thing you said, Ken, was you wouldn't put your kids in a self-driving car now and send them to soccer practice, but in 10 years, you might. 10 years, from a certain angle, is the blink of an eye.
Well, I'm saying at least 10 years. I don't think it's going to happen in my lifetime.
Okay.
But I think it's people are underestimating how difficult these problems are, and I think we really need to be it's creating a lot of fear among workers, who kitchen workers, gardeners, drivers. We're saying that they're about to be replaced, and it's not going to happen.
Howie, you're listening to this from Pittsburgh. Do you feel equally sanguine about the future of American labor here versus robots, or do you see robots coming in and doing lots of things more quickly than Ken, perhaps?
So I think Ken raises two very good points. The first one is, I think people tend to overpredict what robots are going to do because we as humans, we as animals, do those same tasks so easily. You know, I'm a professor, and you know, I can give a class on, you know, give an exam on kinematics, and I'm more impressed that the students were able to get out of bed, get on the bus, walk to school, avoid objects, sit down, put a pencil in their hand. That's amazing.
Okay.
And we're not going to be able to do that anytime soon. The fact that they can do these calculus questions in my exam is, you know, almost of secondary impressiveness. So we do overpredict what robots are going to do, and I have to wholeheartedly agree with Ken. There are a lot of hard problems.
Hard problems, and yet you've got smart people like both of you guys working on this on so many fronts, and we keep ending up seeing machines involved, even if incrementally, more and more in workplace circumstances. I want to begin to go to our callers, Bill in New Haven, Connecticut. Bill, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm a ship designer, so we've been robotic for decades. We continue to become more and more robotic. And the reality is that you choose robots because they cost less in the long term, but they cost a lot in the short term.
And you're talking about them doing ship building or ship designing, Bill?
Well, I design, but of course that means everything in design gets built.
Yeah.
So I'm dealing with yards. So you go in and out of yards, and some are obviously more advanced than others. But the basic thing about robotics is that it costs a lot of money and it's constraining, right? So everybody wants to use robotics and does to the maximum extent that it works. But when things change, if you've bought a robot that can no longer do something for you, then you bought the farm. So I'll give you an example in shipbuilding. We have something called a panel line. That's the most important robot in the shipyard.
Okay.
The panel line makes flat panels that have stiffeners welded on them.
Yep.
This saves an enormous amount of money compared to people having to weld things piece by piece. This also influences design because we design more and more ships to be made out of flat panels.
Yeah.
Obviously, if you cost less to build panels, ships don't have curve anymore.
There you go.
Ships are flatter and flatter. So the robots influence the design, but we still have to have curves, and we can do robotic curves, but it costs too much and it's not flexible enough.
Right.
So it hasn't happened yet. And the reason it hasn't happened is always cost and always change.
That capital investment is huge, and once you've got it, you don't want to change. What about the extent of robots at work in shipbuilding right now, Bill? How would you describe it?
They're highly efficient, but they have to be maintained and they have to be good.
But I mean, is there a lot of it going on? Does American shipbuilding rely on robots?
Oh, absolutely. There wouldn't be American shipbuilding without it. Actually, there wouldn't be American shipbuilding without the Jones Act, but that's a separate question. So, yes, all shipbuilding around the world is robotic and has been for decades.
All right. Well, there it is, where it's happening. It's happening right now. It's affecting the design. It's affecting, obviously, there's big economic calculations that go into that, and it affects what comes out the other end. I appreciate your call, Bill. One more right here. Jake in Pawhuska, Oklahoma. Jake, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm a journeyman lineman for a local municipality electrical distribution system.
So you're the guy up working on the wires, on the poles,
yeah.
Jake? Okay.
And it's inherent. It's inherently dangerous.
Yep.
And you can do everything right and still have something that you didn't expect.
Yep.
Go wrong. And our goal at the end of the day is to get every man or woman
yep.
back home safe and in one piece. We have a lot of safety meetings, as you can imagine. And at the last one, I jokingly said, we'll have in no time robots doing our job, and our job will be to clean and maintain those robots.
Mm-hmm.
There was kind of a nervous laughter in the room, but I think everyone was kind of thinking the same thing, like maybe we're not too far off. But in my opinion, as far as line work goes, you'll still need people who know the job and maybe direct and control the robots. But if we can keep people out of the wires and keep them from being 40 feet off the ground,
yep.
pretty much safer, and worst comes to worst, all you need is a new robot.
So you're talking about robots that would climb the pole or be armed up there and do the electrical work that would keep you out of harm's way at some distance.
Exactly, and maybe like in conjunction with the drone or something.
Yeah.
Everything that's going on.
Jake, I appreciate your call. Yeah, is that Ken or Howie?
Yeah, this is Ken. You know, yeah. It's a great point that was just made by the caller, because this is an example of what I think he suggested was a teleoperated robot. Mm-hmm. In other words, there'll still be humans down at the bottom mm-hmm. in a safe, you know, environment, but they'll be driving the robot who's up on the up on the line. I think that idea has a lot of merit, but the idea that a robot will just automatically drive out and go do the fixing and the electrical system, that is just not in we do not see a path to that. And all researchers that I know, and Howie and I agree, and is that it's really important to push back on this idea that this is around the corner. I mean, we can say all ships are being built by robots, but all the internal wiring and all of the plumbing and all these aspects, there's humans in the loop. So I want to reassure your listeners, this, don't panic. This is not – there is a real myth going on here, and it's not that robots are about to take over.
I don't think we're in the realm of panic. I think we're in the realm of deep curiosity about what's – here and what's coming, but you're right. I mean, when you see headlines that say 38% of U.S. jobs robots will take within 15 years, that does get one's attention. Howie, we've just got you for a couple more minutes here. What are the engineering frontiers where robotics are working now to move forward? What are the challenges? You know, where's the most progress been made in terms of robot capacity, and what are the biggest challenges?
Yes, so I'd like to answer your question, but I also want to add on to what Ken had said.
Yeah.
Yes, there are lots of reports saying 38% of jobs, whatever, are being taken over, but there's lots of conflicting information in the popular media about robots taking over, robots not taking over, even within the same articles. So it really is hardly a conclusion that robots are going to take over all these jobs.
Yeah.
Now, to answer your question about the technologies, there are so many challenges in robotics we have to address. So this listing some, human-robot interaction, how does the person and the robot, the teleoperated robot Ken talked about a second ago, what's the right way to define those interfaces so a person can intuitively use the robots? Machine learning and control, how can the robot perform the task with some precision, some guarantees, and perhaps get better at performing the task as time goes on. Included in that are quicker ways to program the robot. Right now, if you have an industrial robot, it takes 4 to 5 times the cost of the robot, lots of time. Can we expedite that process? Perception, being able to understand your surrounding environment, still is a giant problem in robotics. Manipulation, being able to interact with materials, especially soft materials like the wiring Ken talks about, in order to create an object. Navigation, getting through the environment. And finally, testing, verification, and validation. We want to make sure that we can ensure the robot will do what we say it's going to do. And the challenges just go on and on. But the good news is, for each of these challenges, every success we have, although may seem incremental towards the ultimate goal of whatever Uber robot you want, those increments also have profound impact on automation and on our society, and we should also celebrate those successes too.
It's a lot of challenges, and we get it. Just got you for half a minute more. Where do you see the next big opportunities emerging for robots, Howie?
Oh, I don't know. I'm going to say robotic textile manufacturing.
Textiles. So are we talking
the textile industry?
Are we talking putting out reams of material, or are we talking about the robot in my closet that makes my next suit?
Somewhere in the middle. If we can bring the textile industry back to the United States and I think automation is the key for that. We're going to have more manufacturers of clothing throughout the country. This will decrease the cost, improve quality, and decrease turnaround time. You order it and you get it the next day. Maybe in the future it'll be in your closet, but right now I'd be happy if it's just down the street.
We're watching, we're paying attention. Howie Chosett's helping us do that from Carnegie Mellon's Robotic Institute professor there. Howie, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Support for On Point and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. When it comes to the big decision of choosing a mortgage lender, it's important to work with someone you can trust who has your best interests in mind. With Rocket Mortgage, you get a transparent online process that gives you the confidence you need to make an informed decision. Skip the bank, skip the waiting, and go completely online at quickenloans.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. The sound of a robot there spraying primer coat onto a wall from NTU called PictoBot. We're talking this hour about robots and the jobs they're doing, the jobs they'll do next, and how we'll live with robot colleagues one day. You can join us. How deep do you think the robot presence in our workplaces will eventually be? Are you seeing it already in your workplace? Will a robot one day build your home? Would you be confident in having that done? More confident? Where do you see the limits of what robots are doing, will do? Are there any? I guess, finally, what will we do if and when robots take over job by job? In April, Bloomberg News spoke with Maurice Conti. This is Director of Applied Research and Innovation at Autodesk. That's a 3D design software company, about the status of American jobs. And you can hear Maurice's frustration with the way people talk about jobs and where they go and what might come back.
It's frustrating sometimes to hear this rhetoric about bringing jobs back to the United States that left. Those jobs are actually still here in the United States, but they're being done by robots, not humans.
The jobs are here. They're being done by robots. My job? What about it? We heard on Morning Edition today from NPR that you've got a Canadian company called Lyrebird that can now mimic the voices of specific people. Maybe one day mine. Here's a little bit of fake Donald Trump saying the same sentence three different ways. This is through a software simulation of the president.
I am not a robot. My intonation is always different. I'm not a robot. My intonation is always different. I am not a robot. My intonation is always different.
Okay, I'm told the robot will never do my job, but I don't know. Ken Goldberg is with us via Skype from Berkeley, California. He's professor of industrial engineering and operations research there in robotics, automation, new media at the University of California, Berkeley. With us as well right now from Portland, Oregon, is Claire Kane Miller, correspondent for the New York Times. She writes about gender, families, the future of work for The Upshot, and a recent piece headlined, How to Prepare for an Automated Future. Claire Kane Miller, thanks very much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Are we ready for what's coming? Our robotics guys are saying it's not going to be as big a tsunami as fast as you think here. This is difficult and complicated, and yet the work on it is very steady. Is it being thought through? Can we see what's emerging here, Claire?
It's hard to do because the way to prepare for it is to change the way that we educate ourselves and that we educate our children and the next generation of workers. And as we all know, that's a really slow process. First of all, it takes, 16 years to prepare someone to enter the workforce. And it takes schools a long time to change. They're big bureaucracies used to doing things in certain ways. And so to really prepare the next generation of workers, the people that I talk to say, both in economics and also in technology and in Silicon Valley, is to focus on learning how to learn. That's more important than focusing on, what skill, how are you going to find the job the robot can't do, because in 16 years, robots could be able to do that job. Like you said, the progress is very steady. It might not be happening overnight, but it's steady. So a more valuable way to prepare is to learn how to learn, meaning when you're 30, when you're 50, your career could entirely change. So the skills that you know how to do are not as important as the flexibility and the sort of drive to be able to teach yourself something new, maybe switch jobs, maybe switch the kinds of things that you do in your job.
Learn how to learn. I mean, we've heard that advice for a long time now, and We get it, and yet, you know, human beings being what they are, there's a certain comfort in learning something and sticking with it. But, hey, we're going to have to be flexible here. Claire, Ken, stand by. Dawn is calling from Charlotte, North Carolina. Charlotte, Dawn, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
About 10 years ago, I worked for a furniture factory, and we had about 12 women cutting out the fabric for all the furniture. And I was brought in when they purchased a new laser-guided fabric cutting robot. And those 12 women got moved over to actually sewing. So they added those 12 women to the sewing, and we were able to take a lot more orders because you didn't have to wait for the humans to cut the fabric.
And were you the robot operator, Dawn, or is that your job?
I was the robot operator, yes.
How was that? Was the robot fairly automated, or were you intervening constantly? Was it a partnership between you and the robot, or could you just set it, you know, hit the button,
well,
let it go?
Partnership. Yeah, it was a partnership. I would have to have someone take down the huge rolls of fabric, put it on the machine. I would roll it out, clamp it down, and then I would go over to the computer, which guided the robot. And I would pick out, okay, we need to do 6 of these umbrellas.
Yep.
And we need to do 7 of these chairs. The computer would instantly say, okay, let's do this cutting layout.
Mm-hmm.
This is going to save fabric.
Mm-hmm.
And it was awesome.
So you ended up feeling good about it. You didn't feel replaced or sidelined by the robot. It sounds like you felt kind of empowered.
Well, I felt empowered because I was brought in to work the robot. That's when I came in. But it increased sales because we could take more orders.
What about the women who were moved from cutting fabric to sewing? Was that fine by them?
Not so much.
Uh-huh.
Not so much. They really did not like, you know, one person, me, operating a machine, doing what 12 of them were doing. And they had less wear and tear on themselves cutting out the fabric than sewing constantly.
Right. And now, have you kept up? Do they have a robot doing the sewing as well now, or that's beyond reach?
I think that's a little bit beyond reach. I don't work for that company
mm-hmm.
anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought it was very, very interesting because I actually make costumes for our home business. So whenever I lay out a pattern or I make a pattern, I have to try to figure out steadily where the pieces are going to go to cause the least wastage.
Yeah.
So having a machine do that and a computer do that instantly, it's a huge savings.
Dawn, I really appreciate that firsthand experience of working side by side with a robot there. Let me get one more, if I may. Oneida, New York. Mark is calling. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
All this automation and everything, I was just sitting there thinking, it seems like the only people that it benefits are the ones that have to pay for the robots and the ones that own the businesses and the companies. I don't see the prices for retail don't generally drop. I haven't seen a big, you know, price drop in automobiles, and we have robots in our, you know, manufacturing automobiles. Where's the cost savings for the retail, you know, the buyer, the consumer? I don't see any, I haven't seen a benefit yet. Do you know of an item or a product that's now automated that actually trickles down the savings to the consumer?
Well, that's interesting. Ken Goldberg, jump in there. What about that? Are those with the capital to employ robots going to pass along those efficiencies in cost savings for consumers, or does it not work that way?
Well, one example is Amazon. So Amazon is bringing in huge numbers of robots to manage their warehouses, and they are passing those on. That's why Amazon is so competitive right now. One other thing to keep in mind is that Amazon is also hiring huge amounts of humans. And so your earlier caller's point is that actually in many cases the situation is complex. If you can enhance human workers and human experience with robots. And other examples I'm excited about are in senior care. We're being able to take care of our increasingly older population. It's very hard to find workers for those jobs. And that's where I think robots are going to have a big impact.
Wait a minute. Robots are going to do that work? They're going to take care of our seniors?
No, they're going to help. For example, here's an example. One thing that's very dangerous for senior citizens as they walk around is that if things are on the floor, they could trip over them and fall.
Yeah.
And if you injure your break a hip, you're right, it can be very, very catastrophic.
Yeah.
One thing you would want is a robot that could go around and keep the floor clean, essentially declutter.
Right.
And by the way, I think most of us would like this kind of robot.
I would. I'd love it.
Exactly. And I think that's not that far off. That's not science fiction. I think we're going to see within 10 years a robot that's affordable that will be able to go around and clean up around the house.
Sure. Bring it on. Joel in Davis, Oklahoma. Joel, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Thanks
for taking my call.
Sure.
I heard your comment from Bill Gates earlier.
Yeah.
About robots enabling more thoughtful careers.
Mm.
It struck a chord with me, and I want to say that I'm not a brilliant person, but I do have a master's in atmospheric science.
Yep.
But I enjoy working with my hands, and I enjoy doing jobs that computers or robots will do soon. And I just want to remind the people developing computers, or robots, excuse me, that there is value in people doing what they enjoy. And I'm afraid we'll see some displacement there. So that's my comment.
Joel, that is very interesting, and I appreciate your call. I mean, Claire Kane Miller there in Portland, Oregon, you hear the pleasure that Joel takes in his work. I grew up, you know, baling hay on the farm in the summers. It's hard, physical, repetitive work. We loved it. I loved it. And it was camaraderie, but that seems like something that robots could quite easily do if anybody focused on, you know, having them do it. What about the, you know, Bill Gates says, well, go and have a more thoughtful career. Not everybody wants that, Claire.
It's absolutely true. And a lot of the people who I've interviewed who have lost their jobs to machines, and again, this is not happening overnight. It's not the majority of people, but there are people who have lost their jobs to machines. And that's what they say over and over. They say, I chose my career because I loved to work with my hands. Yes, I realize I could go do something else. I could sit behind a computer all day. Or perhaps I could become a nurse's aide and, you know, help, you know, bathe people in the hospital and change their sheets. That's fine. I realize those jobs are available, but I chose my career because I loved to work with my hands and I love to make things and build things. And, you know, there should be some priority based on that. It's like if you went and told a lawyer, I'm sorry, tomorrow you have to become a doctor, they would say, well, that's not what I wanted to do. It's not what I sought out to do. So that is a really tough piece of this.
Let me get another call here from Dade City, Florida. Michelle, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you. One of my concerns is that over time, if we have machines replacing certain jobs, we lose the knowledge and skill base that's associated with those jobs. If we have skilled masons or carpenters, and then we have machines doing them, if they're replaced by machines, who is able to do that in the event that we can't use the machines anymore?
That's very interesting. Now, let me pick it up. Ken, I know you think this is way out there and it's going to take time. Okay, we'll grant that. But you've got people thinking about it, and we know that the capacity is growing. Artificial intelligence is growing. The engineering you and others are working on is becoming more sophisticated. What about the nuanced human understanding of a lot of these processes as they become more often robotically done? Are you confident that that expertise is sustained over time? Or, you know, could, I don't know, you have catastrophic sunspots and the software melts and suddenly we don't know how to do anything that we learned over 10,000 years.
Well, I think that's a great point. There's going to be a lot of nuances about, let's say, things that humans used to be really good at. For example, farming and being able to do woodworking, things that these kind of manual skills. I think we are a bit in danger of losing those kind of expertise. I think that, you know, that one of the things I'm hopeful in the sense that humans will start to become more refined in their abilities. So as robots are able to do things, for example, in the medical area for assisting radiologists, mm-hmm. I think the radiologists will get better at their jobs. They'll be able to get more nuanced at being able to detect cancers in an image. And I think that's the upside. I think that we will, certain skills will be lost. I think that's inevitable, but other ones will be gained.
Claire, do you think we're just going to turn over certain knowledge to the machines and maybe not sustain it? I mean, I'm sure that there are nuances of harness making and leather working that must have been lost over the last century as we've done less of that. Maybe the same will be future of quite ordinary tasks today, but in the future, you know, the robots will be the receptacles of knowledge, and you won't have as many humans walking around knowing the nuance.
Sure, of course, and that's the story of, you know, the modern economy. As machines have started to do things, we humans have learned better and more sophisticated skills, and we've gotten better jobs, and we've left the old jobs to the machines, and, you know, that's the way it's worked, and that's the way a lot of people hope it will work this time. I think the best case scenario here is that there are workers who are left in the lurch. If you are 48 years old and you get laid off from your factory job and you don't have the skills to do another job, you are left in the lurch. And at that point, public policy needs to help you out. The best case scenario is that that's one generation of workers, and then the next generation, you know, learns new skills and can get to better jobs. I think the reason some economists are very worried right now is there are some signs that pattern, which, you know, has always been followed in history, might not be happening this time, that it might be different, that perhaps machines are getting so sophisticated. And there are some, you know, signs showing up in the numbers that could be happening. Wages have been stagnant for a long time. The share of working age adults who are working has never been lower. Not the unemployed, but the people who have just given up looking for work. So Americans are gaining skills much more slowly than they used to and than other developed countries are. So there are some signs that things are slowing down in the economy and that it might be different this time. Of course, it's too early to tell.
Ken, you're in the robot business, so we're going to trust you here. We're not going to panic about this. But if we want to be optimally ready for the continuing advance of robotics, how do we position ourselves individually and as society?
Okay, great question. I do think that the idea is not to panic, as you said, and also to start to refine our unique skills, the things that humans really do well. And that is things like intuition, perception, being able to the people skills, being able to understand and work with people. These are skills that we want to refine, and we should do it through education, as Claire mentioned, and also through experience, and cultivate this from the early age. And these are human skills. I think we're going to spend more time, hopefully, interacting with each other as humans. And I think that could be a really positive thing.
Okay, everybody, put that in your lunchbox. Intuition, perception, and people skills as the deployable assets of the employment future. You start off talking about robots and end up, well, in that case, right back in the most human terrain of all. This has been really interesting, and I want to thank both of you for being with us. Claire Kane Miller, who writes for The Upshot at the New York Times. Claire, thanks for joining us from Portland, Oregon today.
Thanks for having me.
And Ken Goldberg at the University of California, Berkeley, professor of industrial engineering and operations research in robotics, automation, and new media. Ken, terrific to have you with us via Skype today from Berkeley.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Listeners, thanks so much for joining us. Good luck out there in the robot future. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.